Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 22nd, 2002. Today's session is titled, Communicating Across Cultures, Session 1, How Do We Do Masculine and Feminine? Presented by Jeff Kirsten Grip. The number is KGJ2002-06. Let's listen in.
I'm a professor of communication studies at the University of Portland in Portland, Oregon. I've been teaching college for 18 years, that's correct. But not there, I've only been there about 5 years. So I'm older than I look. Smarter too. And this is a session that's building on a bunch of stuff we did last week. And it's a freestanding session, so if you weren't here last week, don't feel even a tiny bit bad, because you'll understand everything we're doing today and you'll have plenty of opinions to add, I hope. Last week we talked about the idea of cross-cultural communication, how it is to communicate across boundaries, social boundaries we've created for each other, and how to do that more effectively regardless of whether the boundary is national, sexual, generational, whatever it is, that there are things we can do and think and feel that actually help us navigate those boundaries, make us more able and willing to do them. And what we want to do this week, since everybody likes to talk about sex, we're going to talk about sex this week and just about communicating across the sexual boundary. And that people seem to be really interested. About half the examples that came up in last week's sessions from people listening had to do with, when I talk to my spouse, so that's everybody's favorite sort of boundary. So this week we're going to talk just about that. Today is going to be a session focused on how we are talked into masculinity and femininity as we grow. We'll talk about that in a bit, and I want to get your opinions about that as well and your experiences. Tomorrow's session is going to be a little more focused on particular ways of communicating that we have because we are socialized masculine and feminine, that we learn different codes. Deborah Tannen calls them gender-likes. They're dialects specific to our gender, and that given us how much time we spend with people of different genders, you'd think we'd understand the gender likes, but in fact we have real visceral responses to other ways of talking. So tomorrow's session is going to be some of the common problems we have using our gender likes with people from other cultures, namely those aliens. I'm married to the one in the back there who belongs to another different gender culture. And I study this and teach about it, and I still have those visceral responses to it when I hear it. So tomorrow's session will be focused on those things specifically. And then Wednesday, sort of a punchline for the entire series, what I want to do is to pull back some of the stuff from last week where we talked about what it means to be competent interculturally, how you do it well, and apply some of those same principles to cross-sex communication and see if it makes sense to you. See if you start to see, I wonder if my relationship will be different with this other gender if I start to think of them as if they were another culture and start to treat them as if they belong to a different culture. And think of myself also as very culture-bound, not as having the true pedestal position to which all others must then genuflect. But that there are these ways of communicating, and the more I know about them, perhaps the more I know then how to dance with my partner. So that's the goal of the three sessions this week. Today, masculine and feminine. Tomorrow, how do those things play out into these gender lexes? And Wednesday, how then we can navigate in a way that makes those crossings easier. Again, each session will be freestanding. None of them is meant to be part of a series, although if you come to all of them, you'll see the links that are there. This is a book I've ordered for the bookstore. It's a very readable. It's by a linguist, Deborah Tannen. This book has received some criticism, but not a tremendous amount. So it's still something I would offer you as an entree to the world, the gender-likes of men and women especially. She doesn't talk a lot about how we get socialized into being masculine and feminine, but she does talk a lot about how men and women in America at present time characteristically speak to one another, recognize there's a whole lot of diversity within men and women. Okay. So, but this is a book about central tendencies. I think it's like $11. It's not a huge investment. The bookstore has a few. It's also one you can find readily out in the fake world out there. So what I want to do today is I want to first distinguish for you gender and sex. That should take about two sentences. And then I want to talk about what we know about what influences gender, how it is that we get to be the gender that we are. And I want to give you, offer three alternative explanations and advocate one of those. Propose a model for you for understanding how this stuff all works together. And then I want to get your opinions about what it means to be masculine and feminine. And then I'll offer you, once we hear yours, I want to hear, offer you some opinions based on social science. What do we know from people who actually studied this, who make careers out of understanding what it means to be a masculine American, what it means to be a feminine American, and get your opinions about those and how comfortable you are with those and anything you want to do to change those. So that's the progression of today. And yes, we'll be done in time for lunch. Can you believe it? All right. Gender and sex. Sex, you were born into a particular body. You're stuck with it. Okay, that is your sex. Now, even within that, there is some variation. Some people are born with sexual characteristics of both sexes, hermaphrodites, other people who don't have the luxury of knowing what their gender identity ought to be because they look at their body and their body confuses them. Okay, they're not quite sure who they ought to be. So even the sexual categories may not be as clean as we think they are, although generally, of course, they are. So you're born into a certain sex, but you're not born into a certain gender. We are schooled, we are communicated, we are cultured into a certain gender, into a certain set of cultural expectations. Gender, if you like, is a social category, a symbolic category that tells us how to do our sex. Okay? I'm born with a certain body, I get gendered so that then I know how I'm supposed to be. I'm supposed to act. Okay? Oh, I got one of these. Okay, so that means I have to do what? I don't want to give it away because I want to ask you later what you think. So we're not talking about sex here, although it's a great draw to get people to come to the session. But we are talking about gender. And that is, and I think that's just as interesting as sex. Perhaps more. In terms of, it's something that we do with each other. Three explanations are traditionally offered for how we become gendered as we are. The one that everybody seems predisposed to want to believe, because that means it's just something that happens to you and you're not responsible for it and you can't change it, is biology. We say, well, you know, men just have more testosterone than women, and that makes men more aggressive. That's a classic example of a biological explanation for gender and why we act our sex role the way we do. I want to point to an interesting study I ran across from 1991, a study of testosterone and aggression in men in America. And it found that for the most part, testosterone did in fact lead to, higher testosterone led to higher display of aggression, except when the men were of higher socioeconomic class. Why is that?
Thank you.
Maybe you're taught to reason better. Part of being belonging to that class means you value reason over physical violence. Karen?
But you're already on top anyway, so there's no one else.
You acknowledge your privilege within society and don't see a need to lower yourself to do that kind of thing? You don't see a need to engage?
That while there's a biological underpinning for the behavior, that the intellect is able to channel it.
Okay, so we have ways of thinking that can override biology. Go ahead.
The culture of the class-related piece of culture might override the biological piece.
Mm-hmm. It may. Yes, ma'am.
Could it be that their aggression is taken out by taking, being in that position?
Do you feel a sense aggressive of superiority already?
Well, yeah, that sort of, you know, they can be aggressive businessmen, which we don't think of as violent, but, you know.
Maybe. We often think of as nasty. Right. You hear a theme in these five? Common to all five of these responses from you is the idea that biology doesn't trump socialization, that there is something else that can happen to interrupt the destiny that may come with biology. Now, having said that, I have to say that the data on whether biology drives gender role, the jury's really out. There are studies like the one I mentioned. There are also studies that really do link your body's characteristics with the gender role that you offer. But I'm really biased in favor of more social explanations because there I feel like we can be more change agents if we want to. I'm stuck with this body. And so it's okay, I'm actually pretty happy with it, it's fine. But that there are other things I can do in terms of how I act with other people that maybe can influence life for me and those around me and those around them. Whereas if I think of it as just biology, even if that carries some influence, it doesn't carry total influence. It influences, but it doesn't determine, okay? If I think of it as something other than biology, then that gives me some hope that maybe I ought to be, especially as a Christian, maybe I'm called to be something else besides just a slave to certain body parts. A second explanation that's often offered is culture, and says that cultures really mandate what sorts of gender roles are going to be played out. And this, there's actually quite a bit of support for this. If you look at all the studies of men and women internationally and try and make sense of them, as several people have, you discover there are actually very few differences between men and women internationally. Very few differences. That we are virtually identical in our communication, but we seem obsessed with those slivers of difference, you know, where the circles don't quite overlap. We think that that's very important stuff to know. But that also, for example, all men and women worldwide nurture and are aggressive, okay? Both sexes have both. It's not just that men are born aggressive and women are born to nurture, but both cultures have this. Margaret Mead did some really early pioneering studies where she identified for people, she came across three different sets of gender systems that were out there. One where both sexes were socialized to be very masculine, and that was the norm in that culture, that they were just at the extreme end of masculinity, men and women in the culture. Another culture she described where the roles were reversed from what we're used to, where the women were schooled to be very masculine in their behaviors, and the men were socialized to be very pretty and take care of things around the home. And what's the other one?
There's
one where they're both feminine. Yeah, they're both schooled to do what we traditionally call feminine, men and women, a feminine culture. So it's not biology, according to this view, is not destiny. That really it has something to do with culture, and that those things have as much influence on us as the body in which we're born. There's a study of date rape violence in the United States, finding that people who have, in fact, been perpetrators of violence on dates show masculine characteristics, whether they are men or women. Women who use their dates also were seen to be, in the study anyway, were found to have very masculine ways of viewing the world, masculine gender role, even though they lived in a female body. So there are some things that really are cultural about gender. The piece I want to focus on, of course, as a professor of communication studies, I want to focus on the role of communication in shaping gender. In fact, the role of communication in shaping gender and culture and being shaped by it. That's the model I want to share with you. If you think of communication as, how to describe this? I say something to Vonda. Hi, Vonda. She responds with a hi. There's a message there. What was the message? What did you hear me say?
Greeting.
What did I say?
Hi.
I said hi. What did Vonda say?
Hi.
That sounds pretty simple, doesn't it? But you all know there's a lot more there than that. It's like one of those, it's like an icon on a computer screen. Like you could click on my hi, click, and there'd be all this other stuff in there. And like you click on the properties tab and you get to see all the other stuff that's there. For instance, there's a presumption there. So that's the message. These other things, these things that are hidden, we call meta messages. Messages about the message. Okay. So there are things like, Vonda, I'm presuming that it's okay for me to say hi to you in the context of a teaching session. And I'm making that presumption largely based on the fact that Vonda said hi and that she's still nodding even as I say this. Now she's laughing. So all these things have meta messages attached that help us unpack what's going on between people. And that there's a lot going on. We're doing a lot of what's called negotiation as we communicate. We're negotiating our roles with each other. Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, see. You see that? We worked out another one. We're really good at it. There are two kinds of meta messages that are really important. One is about the message itself, that we signal each other how a message ought to be taken. Okay? You can look at a friend of yours and go, ah, you're ugly. And why doesn't your friend go, oh? You know, or maybe he does, you know, and then you both laugh. But how do we know that? Well, we're signaling each other with contextual cues, and the ways we say things, our face, our all these the history we have with each other, all these things play into how we think the other person ought to take the message. Now, sometimes we end up having to fix a meta message with our next message, right? So, you're ugly. I was joking. The meta message becomes the next message, which then has its own meta messages. So one kind of meta message is just about the message itself. Remember, parents, how they told you when they were serious and really wanted you to listen? Sometimes their voice gets really low and they sit you down, and all these things are cues that this is a serious message. Or you signal to each other that you're joking. So we have these meta messages. That's part of what gets clicked on, tells you what's going on. The more important one for our purposes, though, is we also have meta messages about relationship. In any bit of communication I do with you, I am telling you what I think our relationship is. And your response engages me at that level too. Okay? So sometimes you could say to somebody, shut the door! And they might respond by saying, don't talk to me like that. Saying nothing about the door. Right? They're talking about my view of the relationship. And that we're always negotiating those things too. And the idea is, I mean, I said hi to Vonda. Vonda said hi to me. And we'll probably do that some more. But it doesn't mean that we've stopped negotiating our relationship. It doesn't mean that, you know, when you get together with somebody, you're doing a lot of this stuff, trying to figure it out. And then you figure it out and it stops. It doesn't. That when you're communicating with another person, you're always offering these things. Emily and I are offering these things after, what, 10 or 12 years. But that the system starts to look pretty similar. I offer a certain view of the relationship that I'm pretty comfortable with, and so she, and she responds as if that one's still in play, and I offer it again. So it looks like it stopped, but it hasn't. And so for me, that's an opening. Are you thinking about gender? Gender is something we're always negotiating with each other. It's not just that you have a certain way of talking and thinking and acting about gender, and that you've stopped negotiating, so it's like this big rock you'd have to really get going if you wanted to make any change. I think of it like curling. Familiar with curling? Big rocks. But they get moved real easily, don't they? I mean, a big rock in motion, you know this from physics, right? Is easier to move because it's already in motion. If you think of this negotiation as something that's already ongoing, it's a lot easier to think about changing it. Like a curling rock, you move by just sweeping in front of it a little bit, melt a little bit of ice, and suddenly it hits a different rock than it was aiming for in the first place. If you think of communication as a process of dancing with another person, that you're always negotiating, you know, which way you're going, then there is an opening there to go a different way. And that's one reason I really like this idea of communication as affecting gender. Now, I'm not just making this up because I like it. It's pretty well supported. Here's what I want to offer as a model before I ask you a couple of questions here. One is to think about, we've got these accepted gender meanings here, these things that we create. Gender will stand for and mean, and that's what we're going to talk about here. We see communication as not only affecting or reflecting those things so that these drive our communication. Well, my gender says I should be this way, so I will communicate you this way. So we understand the handshake thing. He didn't jump up and give me a big hug. Even though it's holding. We have accepted gender meanings, thanks for playing along, and then communication reflects those, but really communication also affects those. We're dancing with each other, we're negotiating how we're going to be with each other in all of our acts, and they aren't acts where we're talking about our gender role. Hi, my name's Jeff, and I'm masculine. How are you? Is that all right with you? Can I be that with you? Is that all right? You masculine too? All right, which of us is more masculine? We don't do that stuff out loud. But that stuff is happening in our meta communication as we go along. You're laughing because you recognize this. Right? This stuff isn't stuff we do out loud, but it's stuff we do all the time. So we're negotiating, not just reflecting gender, but we're also affecting it by our communication. Communication also has a lot to do with culture. How do you think Holden's culture continues to outlive the generations of people who live here? We keep using the important symbols of Holden with each other when we come. You know, we laugh at things. Spatula was one that was brought up last week. Bread. Hilarity is another. But that we have these things, these symbols, we communicate with each other, and that those things not only reflect cultural practices, but they affect them. Cultures don't endure without support from individuals. Right? Cultures don't endure unless individuals are supporting them. And how do we support them? Individual interactions with other people. We pick on things that we think we want to continue. Important symbols to us, and we keep using them. And they stay in practice then. This piece here, I hope I demonstrated right here, that there are some links shown between culture and gender, and that how we enact our gender also has a lot to do with what the culture winds up looking like. I give you one other example, the word queer, and how that's been reclaimed from being a real pejorative used against homosexuals, especially homosexual men. Now there's queer nation. There's just people, they really embraced the term to become sort of a powerful term again. And now it's actually used as more of a descriptive term in many circles. You could describe, yeah, it belongs to that queer group. You know, you could mean that not as a pejorative, suddenly the term again. And an argument would be the culture has become more tolerant of that group as well. So, last thing, then I'm going to ask you a question. Okay. These words here, this is a different explanation for how gender works than saying it's biology or that it's cultural. It says that in our communication, we are ascribing to another person a certain kind of identity. So when I'm talking to Vonda, I'm thinking of Vonda in a certain way, and my meta message tells her what that way is. And I'm also avowing a certain identity for myself in every interaction. Okay, I'm pretending you are a certain person, and I'm pretending I'm a certain person. And often it's these ascriptions that really lead to gender roles. I could say, Tony, you look like a male. So I think I'm going to talk to you as if you are a male, especially when they're kids, right? You look to see who looks male and who looks female, and that's what I ascribe to them. And so I speak to them as if they are those things, and they respond at varying levels of agreement, negotiate with me about who they want to be. Regarding that. But this notion of avowal and description is really powerful. People say, how is it that kids, this is an example from last week, how is it that kids who are adopted out of other cultures often feel a real longing to get to know those cultures? If there isn't some kind of biological link, if you've been adopted from Cambodia, why is it that you really want to understand Cambodia often, if there isn't this biological link? Well, here's another explanation. You know, you look Southeast Asian, people have treated you as if you don't belong to this culture. Well, then perhaps you're really curious about the one you do belong to. Okay? That keeps getting ascribed to you. Same thing happens with gender, the argument goes. Okay, that we're avowing certain gender identities in how we speak, and we're ascribing other identities also as we speak. And only certain enactments, only certain kinds of avowals, really get the full benefits of American society. Okay, the argument is that we're a patriarchal society, that if you're white and male and heterosexual and relatively affluent, like me, okay, I fit all of those categories, lots of doors are open to me that I don't even recognize are doors until somebody behind me walks into one, you know. Oh, that's a door? He got through. How'd that happen? So the argument is, especially regarding gender, that only certain identities are fully enfranchised in America. Only certain identities are really available. All the rewards of society are really available to only certain members of society. This really makes people downcast to think about this. You think it's going to become a deep and heavy session, and it's not. I just want to offer that as a particular view. For instance, I could teach the class with this particular identity. I could speak in this way. I could. But you're laughing at this voice and you weren't laughing at the other one. There's something about this kind of identity, this kind of gender identity, that maybe doesn't entitle me to the same kinds of benefits as one where I sound different. Like this. Okay. And even knowing I play acting, there were a few people who wouldn't have my eye there. I don't mean that to be mean. You recognize that? Even it's just that we respond to the symbols, we respond to the code, whether we think it's play acting or not. You know, the dance caller who's coming on Thursday to call the contra dance, one of his favorite things, there's a move in a contra dance called a gypsy, where you just, you're turning around, making eye contact with somebody going around in a circle. And very often, he'll be calling that particular move, and he'll say, look in their eye, doesn't mean a thing. Because even though you know it doesn't mean a thing, you still feel called to that code. You understand what it means to look in somebody else's eyes. So we know these codes, okay? You ready for a question?
Mm-hmm.
All right, what I would like you to do, first of all, is find a partner. It doesn't matter if it's somebody you know well or not this time. So feel free to find a partner. And with that partner, I'd like you to say just one thing to them about what you'd like to learn today. And then I'm going to have another question for you once you've done that. Let me rephrase that. I'd like you to find a partner. And with that person, I'd like you to describe one thing you'd like to learn today. I'd like to hear just a few of these, and would you please offer one if you haven't heard it spoken already? What are some of the reasons people are here? What do you hope to learn today? Speak, please. Go ahead.
How do we treat our grandchildren?
Excellent.
These little boy children, encourage the male side of them and ignore them playing with dolls and discourage the doll playing and vice versa.
So some of you are curious about how to communicate with kids who are developing a sense of identity. Excellent. What else?
I have a homosexual son, and that has been interesting communications with people who accuse me or someone else of bringing this about, even though I know it's a biological. And there's always that comments and the reactions.
Okay. So how to talk to people about that particular identity. Mm-hmm. That's a hard one, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like they blame you for this very successful kid. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, it's my fault.
That's true.
I notice more and more a pervasiveness in our culture of the accepted, almost expected way of communicating is satirical, critical, putting people down, and not respectful. It's almost like if you respond to someone with kindness or respect or honoring or affirmation, that's not cool. The cool thing is to demean and devalue the other.
Howard Stern for president.
And it's so pervasive among male and female.
Okay, so interested in some of the ways of talking that have to do with power and community, perhaps, maybe as they're tied up with gender. As a side note, that's one of the reasons I really admire Garrison Keillor, for one. Is really good at lampooning a culture that he also clearly loves.
Right. Right.
But I don't feel offended when I listen to him as he talks about, you know, my parents.
I'm kind of interested in the dynamics of handshaking between men and women. If I enter a room and I'm introduced to people that I, you know, in a business kind of setting, I feel more comfortable, I feel compelled to shake hands.
As opposed to?
Because I see the men shaking hands.
Okay.
As opposed to just greeting them verbally.
Very interesting.
And yet I feel more comfortable shaking hands with a man than I do with another woman. So,
well, in context, she's an executive in the Boeing company, so she is in a very male-dominated environment.
And some settings really call for masculine behavior, don't they?
Yeah.
The way you get enfranchised in those is not by running around and making sure the flowers are arranged nicely. Right? You learned that.
Yeah.
That's an appropriate way of being, yeah. So it's very flexible. I like the guy hug, actually, the handshake hug. You ever had one of those from a guy?
Yeah.
Where the handshake is in between you in case you really have to push the other guy away. It's like a little too intimate, but it starts like a handshake and then let's see, other reasons that haven't been spoken yet. These are very good. These are all relevant to what we're doing.
Kira and I were talking about how you celebrate the differences, and if you just tolerate those and kind of go through into your life with communication, knowing they're there, and how do we deal with that, or do you try to fight them all the time and pretend that they're not there, or
How do you embrace the best aspects of it?
Right.
You're familiar with the Sting song, Englishman in New York? You know that one? It's about a guy named Quentin Crisp, who's a really well-known, very flamboyant homosexual man from Britain, who's here, I think, as an artist. I'm embarrassed to say I don't even know what he does or why he's famous. He may be a writer, but he's some kind of artist. But he says, you know, I speak the way I do because it saves so many questions. That there's this way, and we do it too. You know, we adopt these codes because they tell people, you know, they click on the message and all that stuff is right there. You understand it. So, Karma, what you're saying is, how can I say just what I want to and no more? You know, how can I give the right kind of message via my communication with another person about who I am and about who I think you are and about what I think is an appropriate way of being? You know. Go ahead, last one. Two more.
Well, one of the issues for us is when you're in a conflict situation and I'll say something and I'm perfectly clear on what I said, and Patty hears something totally different. And she's absolutely clear that she heard what she heard. And how much of that is tied into gender stuff? That is conflictual, and it's one where we need to just understand each other better.
Okay. Are you free at 6:20 tomorrow? That's PM, not AM.
Yes, I see that's when you're up next.
Oh, it is. Hey, look. Is. That's the session you'll like. That's the one that will make good sense. Last comment.
Mine is related to that. Do men and women communicate differently?
Do we?
That's the question.
That's a very good question to explore. What I'd love to have you do is, if you don't mind, I know this duo, you split up to opposite sides of the room again, but if you wouldn't mind getting together and combining with another duo so you have a foursome, I'd like each foursome to consider two things. First of all, one, would you rather think about being masculine or being feminine in America? Okay, so that's what you'll have to decide as a group. And once you're there, I want you to figure out as a foursome which four or five prime directives does American culture, in quotation marks now, American culture, give us about being masculine or being feminine? What are the key pieces of enacting that role? If you were being directed by Karin in a play and she was said, all right, you're going to be masculine in this play, what does that mean? What do you have to be? Okay, how do you do it? What are the prime directives? So before you jump up in foursomes, what questions do you want to ask? I want to give you like 10 minutes to do this, so. Okay, there you're off. Find yourself another hair. Become a. Stop your engines. I have found a banana.
It's not actually a banana.
When is a banana out?
Well, you know, I did have a pointer today, and I thought it'd be more credible if I had a pointer. I want to share with you, before I ask what you got here, I want to let you compare what you, in your mind, know your group came up with what the social scientists who studied this have come up with. What they think of as the prime directives for femininity and masculinity. Then I want to hear a few from you, but I also want to ask you some questions unrelated to that, or just that build from it, because the goal of a Holden session is to start a lot more conversations than it ends. So that when you leave, you should still be going all over the village. So that's really the
The answer.
If you took the quiz, you know, you get it correct. You recognizing some of these?
Yes.
If you are schooled to femininity in American culture, appearance still matters. It matters how you look. It matters how you appear to other people. You're expected to be beautiful. I'm not expected to be beautiful. Okay, that's not. Unless I think of myself as feminine, then I wouldn't be expected to be beautiful. I should be sensitive and caring. Worldwide, if you're a woman, you can expect negative treatment as a matter of course just because you're a woman. Not in all cases. You're treated positively very often. But more often than men, you will get negative treatment or less power, less privilege, less access just because you're a woman. And that's part of being feminine, is you are schooled to that idea. Hey, it's just the way things are. Okay, so that's a third thing. Fourth is to be superwoman. You not only can have it all, you better have it all, or you're not really all you could be. And this one, the notion of femininity especially is getting really confused, because we no longer really hew to the old traditional gender roles, except in, you know, selected enclaves within the American culture. And yet we have, there isn't really a consensus about what we're moving to. So it's really in flux, especially for women. It's difficult. Mm-hmm. And I'll say the same thing when we get done talking about masculinity, because it's also in flux for men and very difficult too. We aren't no longer expected to be just that very simple breadwinner, remote from the kids, disciplinarian kind of role, except what are we supposed to, what else are we supposed to be? And how do you do that and still maintain a sense of power and franchise? Masculinity, the prime directive, don't be feminine. Okay, that's the key. And you learn that all through junior high. The worst thing you could be called was a sissy or a fag or a femme. Those were the bad terms when I was growing up in the 70s. That was awful. Be successful. Be envied rather than liked. And not just successful, but be more successful. Always striving to be more and more successful. And the more successful you are relative to other people, especially other men, in American culture, those are the icons. Those are the people we hold up as worthy, as very masculine. Donald Trump comes to mind. An otherwise odious human who still seems to be very popular. Be aggressive. If somebody does something aggressive to you and you are masculine, it is your obligation to retaliate. You need to stand up for yourself. Lots of nodding here. This is appropriate. And if you don't stand up, you know that you've just made a power act. What's the word? You've given up some power to the other person unless you do retaliate. You understand how that plays out. Be sexual. If you're masculine in America, if there's any kind of sexual overtone to any kind of interaction, you're expected to pick up on it and at least let the person know that you caught it and recognize it and think it's funny, whether or not you really want to act on it or not. But men are expected to be sexual as part of being masculine. And be self-reliant. If your car breaks down beside the road, is your first inclination to call somebody?
No.
If you're lost?
Nope.
Not my first impulse, I'll tell you, to ask directions. Although I will do it. My threshold for asking directions is lower than many other more masculine people. What are some of the things you came up with that either contradict or go beyond what's on this list? What did you notice?
One of the things that came up in our group was the assumption from the women in the group that a man is handy, that a man can fix things.
Okay, and that's essential to masculinity is to be handy. Okay, and I put that here. I think that's part of being self-reliant. Okay, you're right on. Others?
Physically strong and mechanically sound.
For women?
No, men.
Oh. Physically strong, mechanically sound, all those things help this sense of self-reliance, don't they? Because you're not going to get stymied by something because it's heavy or because it's difficult. You're going to know how to do it and have the body that lets you do that. Or the tools. That's the other thing. Men have tools.
We make some distinctions in the verbal area that men don't verbal and women do verbal.
About
now,
what?
You know, men act it out, women talk it out. And if you ask a man a question, he will pretty much deflect your question because he will, you know, he want to be in control.
And also in young children, whereas if, say, somebody had a body odor problem in junior high, the girls would just talk about that person, you know, for 2 years and leave them out, where the guy would just come up and go, "You stink, you need to get deodorant," that would pretty much solve the problem.
So a couple things there. One is another finding that I can share with you is that, and this won't be news to you, women do intimacy face-to-face, men do intimacy shoulder-to-shoulder. That a woman would say to another woman who she wanted to get to know better, you know, we should get together and talk. Men, do you say that to your friends? let's go to the game, you know, or let's go have a beer, let's go do something. And in fact, there are even studies of men in interaction in restaurants, and they say, when do men actually start sharing themselves? Well, it's once you've got something in your hand, whether it's a drink or food, and that you aren't truly intimate with another man until you have something in front of you, because it might be construed as sexual. It might be construed as, I want to get to know you. For masculinity, that's not it, right? Really, when it's food and drink you have in front of you, you're just talking, so you have something to do while you're eating and drinking, but really you're just together to eat and drink. It's the same sort of function going on. Now, are you going to dispute me on this?
No. I'm going to add some to it.
Please do.
It seems to me that intimacy between women is seen as more normal and not necessarily having a sexual component. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm much more comfortable sharing pretty personal stuff mostly with women, whether they're lesbian or straight. And that seems, it's like, doesn't seem to be, or, but for a straight man to talk intimately with a gay man, I can imagine would be perceived as threatening.
Well, it's more threatening, I think. Yeah. It becomes a topic of conversation even within the two people sometimes. Mm-hmm. Others?
I think there's still a fairly strong notion that men should be the breadwinner. Okay. That it, when men talk, they say, what do you do? You know, and their whole identity is in what they do.
Right.
And it's harder for men to retire because their whole identity has been tied up in what they do.
I sense some of that here at Holden, too, being teaching staff instead of like a maverick. Well, how much did you work today? Well, you know, I worked quite a bit, actually. Yeah, but what did you do? Did you get sweaty? I'm not hearing this from anybody else. It's just the voice in my head. You know, that's why. Maybe I should write faster or something. Read in a really hot room. So. Do you have other things you'd like to add to this, Aaron?
Cars and sports for men.
Okay, yeah. Cars and sports, meaning if you're masculine, you ought to be interested in those two things.
They're usually,
yeah. You have to at least be able to join a conversation. Mm-hmm. So most men kind of pick a sport that's mm-hmm. obligatory.
I have a great little anecdote that I think kind of describes some of this. Kira's a soccer player, my husband works with them, and one of the coaches from a college team that had coached both a man and coached both women and male teams told a story that was hilarious about the difference between coaching young men and women in soccer. And he told a story about the first half of the game just being horrible. And so we'd gone back with this speech, and he said, all right, you guys, you're all being lazy, no one's in the right position, you're not, your heads aren't up, you're not looking, I saw this, I saw this, I saw this. And he said, and this group of men would, every one of them look around and go, oh, he is, look at him, I can't believe he did that, he wasn't doing his thing, look at this guy over there, and all the women were going, oh, he noticed, I did it. I did it. So I thought that was really interesting when you're talking about, you know, working with young men and women, that you need to be real direct with the guys. You just say, you know, Scott, you were not your head. But with the women, the minute you say anything, it's about all of them.
I'd love to see it. The coach we have at University of Portland, a soccer coach, Clive Charles, actually coached the men's Olympic team in Australia this last time around. And he's a really good coach and he's got a relatively feminine style, or a very androgynous style. He's really quiet and doesn't do that kind of stuff, and it seems to work really well. So I'd love to hear more about how he does that kind of thing. It's all non-stereotypical. How typically do you find yourselves, or how closely do you cue to these directives for the gender that you would assign to yourself? You can think out loud. Go ahead, Gloria.
It's interesting for me. As a woman, I had this throughout my life, if you don't measure up, you don't measure up. So it's all about what I do, what I do, what I do, what I do, what I do. And as I have come into my calling and vocation more defined.
Tell us what you are.
I'm a hospital chaplain.
Okay.
I have really let go of number four up there. And it has been so freeing. So much of my life, yeah, being superwoman, you know, the mom, the student,
but you're a retired superwoman.
Yeah, I came up, and it's probably one of the most freeing things I have experienced in my life.
Has it cost you anything, socially or politically, to not be a superwoman and not aspire to it?
I really don't care. I have come to a point where I really don't care, and this is an aside, but this shows what a growing edge it has been for me, because when we came up for my husband to be on staff, they said, and do you want to teach? I said, no, I really don't want to teach. I want to come up here for a vacation. I'm glad to volunteer and help, but I really don't want to teach. I need a vacation. So I was asked again, do you want to teach?
Do you think it'd be different if, like Karin said, you're a retired superwoman? Do you think it'd be different if you hadn't ever been superwoman?
Oh,
that
yeah.
You didn't have this in your resume? Would it be as easy to let go of what it costs?
cost you as
well?
Yeah,
definitely. Yeah. But it costs a heck of a lot to try and be Superwoman all the time.
Sure it does.
It costs a lot.
Other opinions? Thank you. Go ahead.
I think there are some natural Superwomen that don't realize that everyone else thinks they are.
Am I one?
Possibly. But I just want to make that comment. When I saw that, I thought, well, you know, a lot of women don't aspire to it, but they are, and they come naturally by it, and they're comfortable.
Okay. So sometimes you don't see this as restrictive, go ahead.
On the masculine one, I find that I'm forced not to be sexual. And that,
in what settings?
In most settings. I'm married, and be at work, and you know, so I almost go out of the way to make sure that, you know, this can't be misconstrued as anything but friendly.
Is that sort of a struggle?
No, it's not a struggle, it's just a conscious effort. Meaning that I notice that I have to change my communication style to make sure that it's clear.
Good
for you.
Go ahead.
I just want to add to what Paul said. I think that's true for young men today. They're a little confused as to how they can approach a woman without sounding like they're coming on to them. And because they feel that there's all these sexual assault, you know, sexual harassment cases and so forth. And so they're real concerned about what their identity should be.
Okay, well, let me fold this into one last question to chew on then, and that is, given the barriers you're starting to describe, some of the places where you feel restricted or places where you feel you have to do a lot of self-monitoring and self-editing, you see some barriers between how it is and how you'd like it to be. What are some things you can see yourself doing in your own communication, given that that's one influence on gender, not the only, but one? What are some things that you could see yourself or the people around you doing in communication that would move us toward, let's say, gender justice, something that would be more like what we could aspire to? I heard one thing, Paul, right?
Yeah.
I heard one thing from Paul that said, well, I just pay attention to what I'm saying and make sure that I'm not using sexually suggestive language when other language would do. That's one thing you can do in your communication.
We as people of the opposite sex should not attribute those qualities to the males, for instance, and try to have talk about meaningful things instead of just saying, well, what did you think about the Mariners? I mean, we're responsible for part of this as well.
Mm-hmm. Or talk to the women about, what did you think of the Mariners?
Yeah.
What if I switch the headings here? Could you see yourself enacting this role entirely? It would be so difficult for me. Mm-hmm. Some parts. What else? Go ahead.
I work in a ministry agency that our director and our associate director are women, and so it's just more, I feel more acceptable to be feminine working there. And didn't notice it until I went to graduate school and I was the only woman in a classroom of about 30 male pastors, and I realized, whoa, I'm not practiced at this kind of communication. I'm falling behind. I can't get in there quick enough with my stuff. And so I think that's one way to do justice is have women in leadership positions.
Mm-hmm. Well, have feminine styles in leadership positions.
Yeah.
Emily used to work for an all-female agency that was very masculine in orientation. Others? Thank you.
I was going to observe that during the 70s, when I was a teenager, we did try and flip those lists upside down. Mm-hmm. And it was very confusing.
Mm-hmm. And costly in some arenas. What did you notice?
Well, the other point I was going to make is that I heard that across the board, culturally, that men do tend to be competitive and individualistic. Women tend to be cooperative and communal.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that in terms of conversation, to be less competitive, or at least to recognize reality is I can struggle with that, but I do have that tendency, is I want to be aware of who you are and where you're coming from.
Mm-hmm. And how you're seen.
Right.
Other people see you wearing the role, whether you see it or not. Sorry.
No, that's good. You completed it.
That was it?
Yeah.
Because you were talking about having women in leadership positions. I think it's also incumbent upon us to be aware of how the other, how someone who's probably wearing the other gender would prefer to communicate as well. I mean, your classmates could help you a bit, too, by not necessarily going full-on masculine in, you know, alpha male stuff in class, or asking, you know, what's your name?
Mary.
Mary said something really cool to me on the break. Can we hear it? You know, that's something you could do within context of communication that would also make space for these other styles. Last comment, Karen.
One of the things, too, is for ourselves to push. I mean, some of those femininity things fit me. Mm-hmm. Some of them really don't. And to become a little more at ease with pushing the boundary just a bit, to not always be, appearance is hardly not an issue for me, but to take on some of the masculine things for myself. We talked about that in our group. It used to be that I'd repair the bikes and Tony would take care of the car. He does more of the grocery shopping, I do more of the plumbing. And it's sort of, that's not a political statement, it's just kind of who wants to do what. Do you know what I mean? It's,
yes, absolutely.
And who has the talents?
Yeah, who has it?
All where they may, rather than assigned.
Yeah, and it's, and there are some things I really don't want to do, and that's up for negotiation.
Okay.
But, so maybe. But to push the edges a little bit from on both sides.
Mm-hmm. And to maybe, yeah, make sure that you recognize what you're actually doing through your communication with other people is negotiating these gender roles and being really conscious of the fact that my statements to you, even though I'm not saying how I want you to be explicitly, implicitly I am. I'm saying who I want you to be relative to me and who I want you to be, period. And that if you're conscious of the meta messages you're giving along with the messages, that's one sort of everyday mundane way to justice, is to genderize each other in ways that are more oriented toward equality and equal opportunity. I see other hands, but I can't because I have to go get my kids from Narnia. Come back tomorrow, 6:20. Thank you for coming today. Your insights were very useful.